and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Bhavya Bogra, who is doing a PhD in Geography and Planning under the supervision of Dr. AJ Agarwal. Welcome to Grad Chat, Bhavya.
Thank you, Colette. I'm glad to be here.
Well, that's good because I was going to say next, we finally got you on the show. So thank you for coming on. Bhavya and I have actually known each other for some time now, as she's one of those grad students who have attended many of our professional development opportunities that our grad students can have while they are here, along with also being one of our graduate inclusivity fellows and one of our bloggers. So you know the graduate life here at Queen's really well. What do you think of it?
I think it's super amazing. And being an international student, I have been exposed to a lot of wonderful opportunities. So that's why I enjoy to be part of different opportunities or initiatives by SGSPA.
So I mentioned a few different things there. Perhaps you can explain what a graduate inclusivity fellow is.
Definitely. So as the term says, we are graduate students, yes. And when it comes to inclusivity fellows, which means we are representing a community of graduate students at Queen's as different fellow mates, and we are 6-7 people. And we try to answer questions of prospective students who want to join Queen's, or maybe sometimes current students who are at Queen's, about various things they are stuck at. Either it could be housing, it could be, you know, life at Queen's, it could be life at Kingston. And sometimes they could be questions specific to the department. So we try our best to answer those questions and support them.
And we're really lucky because we have 6 of them each year, and you've all come from different backgrounds, which I think is really cool. You're not all international students.
Yes.
And so it's nice to get that perspective. I would imagine as a prospective student, rather than just hearing from us administrators and saying, yeah, we're a U-Butte school here, you can give them, you know, this is what it's like. And it's not like it's all simple. Yeah. I mean, we can always make it out to look fantastic. There's a lot of times, as you know, that you sometimes you have to put yourself out of your comfort zone and meet new people.
Right. So when it comes to me, I've been trying to answer the questions in a way that I tell, okay, this might be a challenging spot when you join in, but this is how I navigated with the resources Queen's has it. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you will be able to do it. So there are both ways of seeing that mm-hmm. coin. But yes, I agree that as a student myself, I am able to tell them, okay, this is a challenge or not, and not just show the fancy picture.
Yes, because it's easy for us to do that, right? But as I always say to people when we're trying to explain, do we think the graduate journey is easy? No, we're realistic. We know there's ups and downs and bumps here and there, and more challenges sometimes than others. But there's a way around to navigate it, isn't there? That if we always think of, oh my God, doom and gloom, yeah, we're never going to solve the problem and get out of it.
Right.
So as like a graduate inclusivity fellow like yourself, it's saying, yes, you are going to have some problems.
Yes.
But here's a way that you can turn that around. And as you quite aptly said, it was about there are resources on campus that can help you with your writing if you need a bit more help. There are people, you know, the student wellness services.
Yes.
How many places can you go to a new city and automatically have access to health services right here on campus?
Indeed. And student wellness is one of those, I feel, other spaces which are more comfortable or inclusive for us as students would be international centers, some spaces within libraries.
Correct.
There are different libraries, and I'm pretty sure everyone must have not explored each corner of library. So I do that every summer, try to find out different parts of what Queen's has. So I agree that it can be overwhelming at the start, but when you understand what are the resources and you understand that everyone is trying to help you navigate your journey and help you accomplish what you are here for, then it becomes amazing.
And I was going to ask you this question, but I'm going to give you the answer as well. Because one of the things I say, no, if there's one thing you want to tell a new grad student when they're starting, what would it be? And for me, it would be create a community. Don't wait for the community to come to you. You look for the community.
Yes, and this helped me. To be honest, this is one of the biggest assets to my journey, because when I started in 2021, it was kind of a COVID era still, and people were more into themselves. So there was more isolation and then different academic challenges or changes to my journey. And the first thing which helped me was connecting with people who either were having similar challenges and talking about those challenges, or who were here and, you know, were trying to help other people. So that kind of one-to-one support and other things started helping me. And that is one of a separate part where I am part of a club.
Which I love. Yeah. I love it, because we're very fortunate here at Queen's. We have so many clubs on campus. I mean, you name it, we have probably got it. And if we haven't got it, you can make it.
Yes, that is actually the wonderful part. I never knew that a student themselves can create a bigger community. And if you intend to, you can have club for any sort, as you said. And I think I remember someone telling me that we do now have a potato club where people who
potato
are...
Potato club?
Yes.
I love it.
This is the funniest thing. And if you just love eating potatoes, you can be a part of the club, and they, you know, try to have different recipes with potatoes, something like that.
That is brilliant.
Yeah. Brilliant. So you name your hobby and you might find a club to interact with. And I think clubs can be based on different interactions or different kind of things people are looking for. It can be based on your, you know, cultural beliefs. It can be based on your hobbies. It can be based on the development you want to do in yourself, speaking, debating, you know, any kind of sport. So, yes, there are, I think, more than 300 clubs, if I remember.
Well, that's a lot. Even 20 would be a lot, but that amount in the hundreds is even better. So now, your background, you're an architect. I mean, that's what you did in India, your home country. And I guess you're sort of close to that because you're in geography and urban planning. What made you switch from architecture, which most people think that's more about a building, as opposed to more on the geography, urban planning, which is development, designing a place as opposed to a structure?
Thank you for this question, Gaulette. I think from last 10 years, I've been waiting for this answer myself. Like, I'm interrogating or introspecting myself, like, what is this journey for me about? But maybe today I can answer in a way that how architecture helped me shape or helped me navigate to this particular aspect of urban planning. I believe architecture, first of all, in India, it's a 5-year course. So when we were doing architecture, we were exposed to different courses within that. One of those were architectural journalism, where I started learning about how to write which is already there, or how to interview people who are passionate about creating different forms of buildings or different forms of cities.
Right.
So that was my first exposure to talk to few people back in India who are working on cities or different projects of community housings and such sorts. So that was my first curiosity. The second aspect was, I think the major difference between architecture and planning is architecture can be a thing where you can have a vision today and you can make it happen within the next few years, like 2 to 5 years, and you will see it happening, like either it's a form of building or an interior designing or whatever form you're doing. And that gives you a satisfaction or accomplishment that what you started designing is now taking a shape.
Right.
Whereas urban planning, on the other side, or city planning, is about patience, because you are visioning something for a city on a larger scale, which might not even happen in your lifetime, and you will create something for the societies to come. So I always wanted to be a social entrepreneur and enter into a field where I can see, you know, a bigger impact on the communities. So that is my motivation for that. Other thing which gave me the motivation to switch to this bigger part was when I observed cities in India or various small spaces in India where I saw that there could be a lot of impact which can be done for vulnerable communities that could be lower income groups or that could be, older people or women in general. I realized that there is still a scope of a lot of development and visioning needs to be started, which was kind of missing in the research section or the development sector of policy making or planning.
Okay, so I guess we should get onto your research.
Definitely.
Because that's why we're here, but it's been a great conversation already, so thank you. So your research topic is, which is an incredible one to be looking at, travel needs of older adult women in mid-sized Canadian cities. So let's have a look at that. And I'm just wondering, first of all, maybe just give us an overview and then let's go into some important questions, because I think you've hit a bit of a niche area because we are an aging population here in Canada.
Yes.
And we need to consider that with the design and of our cities as well as other infrastructure within a city. So perhaps just a bit of an overview first.
Yeah, definitely. So I'll start with the why older adult or why older adult women. My first motivation was my grandmother. Throughout my life, I've seen her struggling because she was not able to use any vehicle. And she was dependent on my father or on us for a lot of needs. And as she turned 65 and 65 plus, she had challenges of walking. So that was my first understanding of how older adults who are growing in population globally will have various challenges. When I came here, I observed similar challenges, but on another side, because people here, they have a capacity to drive and they can drive into later years of their life. But
Some shouldn't.
Again, I think the rule here is at 80, they have another test to verify whether they can continue driving or not for older adults. Oh, by the way, I should actually tell my audience here what older adults I...
Yes, good point.
Yes, sorry. So individuals who are above the age of 65 are considered older adults by the definition of Human Resources and Skills Development Canada.
Okay.
So the same definition is followed for my research. Anyone who is 65 and 65 above are considered as older adult umbrella group.
Thank you for not coming to see me.
Maybe after you retire.
Yeah, not quite there yet.
I'm still working on it, so maybe you'll get a call.
Yes.
And when I talk about travel, as you said, so sometimes there is a confusion that I'm talking about international travel or travel with flights or airports. No, I'm here talking about local travel, which means the local movement of older adults within their city limits that may be needed for various activities, including grocery or, daily medical appointments. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean about their travel. And mid-sized Canadian cities, again, a prominent term to understand. Medium-sized cities, they range from about, 10K to 1 million people.
Okay.
So those are all mid-sized cities all over Canada.
So like Kingston?
Like Kingston, yes, which has a population of 1,32,000.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. So this is about mid-sized cities. And why mid-sized cities? Just a differentiation. Mid-sized cities like Kingston, Peterborough are growing with older people who are coming and settling over there or who are retiring and they want to move to a smaller city and away from the hustle bustle of bigger cities of Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, Vancouver. That was the first reason. But the other reason is, in general, overall, the older adult population is growing in Canada, as you highlighted.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to see not about the bigger cities who might have more resources to cater at the city level, but the medium-sized cities, they will have lesser resources and more older adult population in next 10 years.
Right.
Then how will they respond to the needs of older adults?
Which is important because, as we know, if we're talking transport, the main transport here in Kingston is the bus system.
Yes.
And if not that, then it's a taxi or an Uber or relying on a mate or a family member to get you around, isn't it?
Yes. And
because the cycle paths, I know there is a few, but they're a bit dicey. And at that age, you probably don't want to be on a
very true.
Cycle
and
path.
Based on what my initial understanding from my current interviews, I realized that the primary dependency is on the friends or family and not on public transportation or Uber or, you know, ride hailing services, because they still feel it's either unsafe or not reliable in many ways.
And I think there's a question there, right? When you talk about families,
yes,
right? And in the past, the family unit was very, very close and everyone looked after the family.
True.
That's changing. Society and the family unit dynamics is changing. Now, I know in Kingston, there's some families here who've been here for generations.
Right.
But then there's a lot of new people coming into the city.
Right.
For instance, graduate students who have dependents.
Yes.
And it could be parents,
yes,
with them who don't know the system as well and maybe can't always jump on a bus whenever they want to, whether it's the time scheduling or it's just too difficult to get to the bus,
yes,
initially. So, you know, a family dynamic where we used to be able to rely on the family supporting each other, that's added an extra layer, hasn't it, to city development?
Indeed. And a lot of researchers or the past research has shown that within this layer of family dependency, or maybe the duration of time a person is staying in the city, affects the use of the resources they are doing within the city.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, when you said a person who is living from generations here, who has grown up here and now getting older, will be more comfortable in accessing multiple resources or transportation resources available to them to reach to their locations. Whereas a person who has just moved to Kingston because of various reasons, either to reunite with their family who are living here, or maybe they're coming back from Toronto after their retirement back to the city. But they observe that the city has changed or the city is new for them and the dynamics have changed. I remember one of the participants said, oh, earlier I used to live nearby Kingston Center and, you know, this place was not there, this place was not there. I used to go to this place just by walk, but now the traffic has increased. I cannot walk to that place and I feel challenging to, you know, continue my social activities which I used to do in my other city. So there are various layers of challenges within this bigger umbrella.
So how does then the intersection of gender, aging and immigration, because we have a lot of refugees that have come here through,
yes,
the various government initiatives, is there unique mobility challenges for older women?
Yes, I'm going to start in general. So that's how I see it. Like, I have a bigger umbrella or a bigger circle of older adults. Then I have a subsector of that, which is older adult women. Within that older adult women, I will have a sub-subsector, which is called older adult immigrant women. And this whole umbrella needs to be understood holistically so that we come to some conclusion or devise some kind of age-friendly initiatives in the city. How we can do it? I'll come with the bigger umbrella. So for older adults in general, the mobility is tied to their health, independence and social participation.
Mm-hmm.
It will help them accomplish their aesthetic needs or psychosocial needs, which means enjoying their daily life as they used to do, being independent and going to their grocery shopping, going to their medical appointments, even going to their, you know, hair spa appointments,
yes,
as they used to do and they continue doing. This becomes exceptionally relevant for women because they tend to live longer, they are more likely to live alone and have lower incomes than their male counterparts.
Right.
So mobility limitations are also linked to mental health issues such as loneliness, depression and anxiety. Reduced mobility now in older women will exacerbate the feelings of isolation and impact their psychological well-being. So it's just not only they're not able to do these things on a daily basis is impacting their daily needs, but in a bigger sense, it is impacting their overall health and well-being.
Right.
And when you said the intersection of gender, aging, and now immigration, and why so? Because we see that in the past few years, the immigrant population has been growing in Canadian cities.
Mm-hmm.
with South Asians being the largest immigrant group. I remember 7.1% of the total Canadian population is now South Asian.
That's right. Okay.
And when I say South Asians, I mean for my research, they are people from one of the five countries, which is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. So people or individuals from these five countries have been settling in Canadian cities, and they either might have come earlier, but now are aging here, or they might have come in last few years or last few decades and reunited with their kids who were living here. So in respective of that, they are settling here. And why their needs would be different is because these immigrant women, they come from very different socio-cultural context. When I say this, I'm going to give one example. For instance, within Muslim communities, customs and laws limit women's ability to work or travel outside the home. That means those women will undertake fewer trips, exhibit shorter trip chains, and spend less time traveling, make fewer stops, and then they will come back home, which is very different from the men's travel on a daily basis in those South Asian countries.
Right.
And it is being said that when they immigrate, they kind of follow the similar pattern, and then they have more barriers and unfamiliarity with the transportation system here, which will impact their aging in these cities.
Okay, so what are some of the things you're finding? Because you're doing interviews, is that correct? So explain how you're putting together the data to help you come up with some sort of hypothesis, something to sort of give to various levels of government. Explain how you're trying to get some data to make your thesis.
And if they were able to reach to certain point, maybe using a bus or something, were they able to feel satisfied with that trip or not? So both ways, we are missing this information in the quantitative data.
Missing the user experience.
Yes. So that is why qualitative methods such as interviews and focus groups were chosen for this research. And more specifically, because still the data in Canadian census or surveys like these are missing information from immigrants.
Right.
So even though I use those data, I cannot justify anything for how older adult immigrant women are using or doing their daily activities based on their travel, because we don't have such data as of now. So, but to your question, why this data or what this helped me to do, this kind of data from interviews, like I generally go, I should say a little about my recruitment process. Mm-hmm. So when I started for my interviews or recruitment process for my interviews, I generally use the local cafes as well as senior center and other places where I find more seniors would be or older adults would be going.
Right.
And I posted my posters there, and I think you helped me posting in the graduate newsletters, and as well as use the professors over in Queens to help me recruit participants. So it started well, and I have talked to more than 25 older adult women, local born older adult women as of now. So what kind in general they are providing me is I'm able to understand their nuanced experiences in relation to travel in their own words. And how I do it later on is I transcribe my whole data. I use a certain software called NVivo. I have to now code those data to understand whether they have similar challenges or whether they are individual themes which are coming out from data. But in general, I understood that majority of the women, they are still not able to use public transit in the city. And they say one of the reasons is they are not comfortable that those resources within the bus, either because of limited seating, they feel that in the peak hours, they're not able to get a seat to sit properly and reach their destination is one of the problems. The another problem is their bus is not dropping end-to-end connectivity, basically. So if you start from your home, you have to reach to a certain X place. The bus stop is 10 minutes far from that X place. So they say they still have to walk, which is sometimes a troublesome position for those people.
I think one of the troubling thing you just said before was they don't think there's enough seats on the buses. And the days of people getting up to give someone who's very able-bodied, young, etc., of getting up and giving a seat to someone who needs a little bit more assistance and would prefer to have the seat, it's gone the way of the dodo, as I say. That respect for people who need either the elderly or pregnant women or some person that may need a bit more assistance, I think that needs to come back in our society.
True. And that is what I say, that's kind of social behavior that we need to, again, look back into and develop, maybe through more programs. Or this might have happened post-COVID where people have forgotten how to get back to a society routine.
Yes, yes.
Other thing, thank you for raising this, because I have been using public transit in Kingston since I came here, and I have observed multiple things in the bus, and I think that's the way I look into this, that Kingston is a living lab for me now,
yes.
Where people in medical research, they go to their labs and perform things. I use this city as my lab and, you know, conduct daily experiments when I'm in the bus. Okay, this is the time I am in the bus and I'm observing how many older people are sitting there or how many disabled older people are getting into the bus or trying to get into the bus. And one of the interesting thing I observed is you can have two older disabled older people in a bus because they have kind of certain ways on left and right in the starting of the bus to accommodate those people. But sometimes a third person is standing at a certain bus stop. So they tend to are not able to get into the bus. So that's another challenge I felt.
Right.
Like,
yes.
It's just one umbrella of seeing people of older adults under those sections. But there are people who are disabled older adults who might have certain other challenges of, you know, not understanding language. They are excluded from, you know, public transportation facilities.
It's interesting because someone could easily say, well, you know, there's times during the day where you don't have students jumping on and off a bus at those peak hours or people leaving or going on and leaving to work for the normal working hour. So why not choose some of these others? But the problem, of course, is if they've got an appointment, it's not necessarily in the quiet hours their appointment. So they've got to get there during a busy time or go so early they'll be sitting around for ages, which isn't good for them either. So it's getting that happy medium, isn't it? It's not easy.
Yes. And all the 25 women I interviewed, they said that they have cancelled appointment multiple times just because they did not have their transportation. So
right.
It is a very valid problem or a challenge for them. And there is another thing that they had to sometimes, you know, choose between what they can do in their lives now as they're turning older.
Mm-hmm.
And this left them helpless. And, you know, the feeling is not very good or happy. I remember one of my participants wanted to actually go to her best friend's funeral. And she kind of had tears in her eyes when she was telling me the story. So all those data or information I'm trying to gather is also helping me uncover those challenges which are not understood through other sorts of data, which is quantitative data. And I'm sorry I deviated from your question.
That's right.
Your question was how it will help the data or the analysis will help city. So I say, like, every city has a separate context. So it is one size fit will not follow to all the cities, but we can start from one city to understand what are their different layers of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Kingston is a university town, whereas other city which is a nearby Kingston being an university town has slightly better public transit, just because, yes, we need public transit for students, at least in
right.
and around the downtown neighborhood or downtown areas. Whereas, again, the suburban areas of Kingston, the people living there or residing there feel they are often disconnected from what is happening in downtown.
Right, right, right.
So the challenges depend on the built environment of the city and also on the context of how city focuses on certain aspects.
It's going to be interesting. So, I mean, I know you're observing, you're listening to what people, which is not an easy way of doing it, to be able to collect that data and compare apples to apples sometimes. It's not as easy as a number. So what are you hoping to achieve from this research in relation to changing the strategy in Canada as a whole to make cities more inclusive for mobility policies, for the aging, to be honest, any sort of age group? I mean, you've got the young kids, we've got to be careful on those. We've got the aging population, we've got the people in the middle, the people that need to get to work at a certain time because
yeah.
it's the peak time for them to be at work.
Yeah.
So how are you hoping to use this work?
So by 2050, more than 25% of the total population of Canada is going to be older adults. Imagine every fourth mm-hmm. person around you would be 65 or 65 right. above. Mm-hmm. And if you don't plan or think about challenges they're facing, it's going to be a more difficult time which is coming ahead. This is one way. But the other aspect to that is WHO, World Health Organization, mm-hmm. they launched age-friendly city framework in 2007, I believe. And from then, they have been trying to understand all over the world how the cities are aging, because aging is happening all over the world. It's not just mm-hmm. Canada, and maybe more in Europe and, you know, Japan. So the challenges are real. And they have tried to understand what are the important pillars where cities can work on with their framework, and transportation is one of the important aspects of that. They believe that if you make people connected through some sorts of ways, it will help them maintain their, you know, identity or independence and live in a certain aspectful or a healthy way throughout their older years. But for Canada or Canada's aging strategy, or I would say we need to figure out, as a national level, we'll have a aging policy or aging framework in place. But then we have three layers again at a national level. Then we have provincial level, which is Ontario. And within under province, we have local municipality level. So Kingston, I plan to conduct interviews with the transportation planners of the city right. in future mm-hmm. and talk more in depth about what are their future plans in terms of considering various diverse groups within city, residing in city now, and as well as in growing population. And how are they catering to it? Is there any other age-friendly plan coming in soon? Because it's been more than 12 years, I guess, since the last right. plan came out. And what is the vision of that? So that is one way. But the other way is to, like, the process of the data collection I have started or have conduct, I'm been doing. This data itself becomes an evidence or data-driven form of planning for City of Kingston. If I provide those kind of strategies mm-hmm. or those kind of data to them, they might be able to understand and integrate this to their future in general, Kingston's plan or city plan, master plan, as well as age-friendly plan, and improve or, you know, talk about the different challenges of older adults in the city. I can add one thing, like, for instance, when we were talking about suburban areas where transit options may be less frequent or accessible. And I understand that we need a lot of money to just plan the public transit. So we cannot just say, oh, you don't have a bus stop, let's plan for it. But we can figure out what can be local transit solutions based on, again, mm-hmm. the needs or the specific population of that neighborhood, such as shuttle buses or maybe community-driven transportation programs right. to ensure that older adults of a particular group can access or participate in certain social activities.
Which I think is important. It's as you said, right back in the beginning, it's having that social connection. I don't think it'd be so, the transport would be so much of an issue if they can get to the places for the social interaction.
Yes.
Which is really, really important. And it's interesting thinking about Kingston. Kingston has an aging infrastructure.
Right.
You can see that every day with the roads getting ripped up and new pipes being put in. To me, it's also when we're looking at that, where we need more stormwater drains or more water or the sewerage outlets and things, we should be thinking again, well, how's this also going to work with the transport?
Right.
You know, is this a time that we can shift how we look at the transport at the same time? If we're right. ripping up roads, right. what else can we be doing if we're ripping up that road?
Right.
And it's making people aware to look at not just, I need a new pipe.
Right.
What else can we be doing when we're ripping up?
Yes.
And making a hole in the ground to yeah. fix one pipe? Because I've seen it. I've been here 18 years and they yeah. 1 year on Union Street, they rip it up to put a new pipe in. Then they rip it up to put cables in. And then they rip it up to do this. And so the same piece of road seems to be pulled up
right.
so many times, or opened up so many times. And you think, why don't you just do it all in one go? And maybe it is a financial thing.
Yes.
But it's getting, I would imagine, with your work, it's very much of, you know, this is what's happening. This is what this population is telling us. We need to consider this whenever we're thinking about what do we need to do next for the city to make, one, people want to stay in the city,
right,
and two, to be able to enjoy the city
yes.
and its surroundings.
Yes. In my definition or in my way, I say it like acknowledgement and then taking steps after that acknowledgement mm-hmm. is a good start to even in envision or, you know, start the process of what is going to come next. Because mm-hmm. if you remember, we started talking about maybe a city is such a, I say it's a beautiful creature because, and when I say a creature, I mean, sometimes I think the transportation system is kind of the way we have arteries in our body. It's kind of arteries and veins of a city. So it takes years to, you know, improve and it changes. It keeps on changing. It's an organic system where people are coming in, going out of the city and yes. the needs are changing. So it sometimes becomes difficult when it comes to planning of new infrastructure based on the funding the cities has or the local municipalities has. But if we start acknowledging or if we have evidence or data to acknowledge something, then it's a, you know, a beautiful start of a visioning for something which is going to come in next 10 or 15 years.
Brilliantly said. And with that, we're going to have to finish because we've come to the end of our show.
Wow, so. I had so much more to talk about.
Yeah, we never have enough time on these shows. I used to think in the beginning 15 minutes was enough, and then I realised 15 wasn't enough, and then we went to the half hour. It was just brilliant. Anyway,
yeah,
Bhavya, thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining to us some of the challenges that our own population here in Kingston
yes.
have, but how that can also be looked at on a wider scale too. So thank you very much for doing that.
I guess I should thank you for, you know, inviting me, and I tried my best to explain things in layman terms.
Well, you succeeded, so we're all good there. So thank you.
Thank you, Colette.
You're welcome, very welcome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, of course, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just type in a Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.